Welcome to Bombshell from War on the Rocks. This is our first episode of the Trump administration. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I would say that we have lots to talk about.
I think that's right.
I haven't slept in like 9 years, I think, from all the things we have to talk about. I'm so excited.
This is supposed to be an every other week podcast. Where this could be an every other day podcast at this point in the news cycle.
I could call you guys at 2 a.m. every night and say, can we do a new podcast literally right now? Because my tweets are smoking.
It's true. You're getting some serious retweet action out of that. Radha has some institutional...
I'm learning about the Twitters.
...prerogatives, which reminds me, we should say that none of us here speak for our employers. I guess technically I speak for my employer because I am my employer. But neither Radha nor Lauren are speaking on behalf of any institutional prerogatives broader than their awesome selves.
For which they thank God every day.
So, don't get us in trouble as we walk through the last 2 weeks' worth of news from our nation's capital. The first segment we're going to do is we want to talk a little bit about things happening not in the United States as best we can. I'll be honest, it took us a little bit of effort to come up with some useful topics for this segment, which we're calling Keeping Up Foreign Relations, you know, communicating. We've had one foreign visit in the last few days from Theresa May, where we discovered potentially President Trump is afraid of walking down stairs and slopes. We've had a canceled visit from the Mexican president, who sort of in protest of this discussion of the wall and the Mexican government paying for the wall. But I want to go into the way, way back machine to 2 weeks ago to this Bild interview that they did. There was with the German newspaper Das Bild and the Times of London, where we got sort of some of the first glances of Trump's President Trump's foreign policy toward Europe discussion. And I mean, I guess for this section on kind of foreign relations, the emphasis should be on what our foreign allies' response was. But I think that it was certainly, it had this characteristic, it struck me at least, of being shocking, despite being exactly what he's been saying for a year and a half.
So that's the weird part of the last couple of weeks overall on a lot of policies we'll talk about later, that you know Trump was not shy during the campaign about saying that he did not think that NATO was being particularly well-resourced, that he thought it was not terribly relevant, that he questions the United States' commitments to countries in the Baltics and elsewhere, and whether or not we'd actually do anything to defend them against any kind of incursions on their security. But we all kind of thought during the Mattis confirmation hearing and the Tillerson confirmation hearing and later on that maybe he'd backed off of that. Maybe he learned his lesson and thought that, NATO is kind of a pain in the ass, but NATO is actually really important to our national security. Well, this interview showed that pretty much no. He has basically exactly the same thought process that he was very clear about during the campaign. And allies...
And as Tom Wright has pointed out, has been clear for almost 30 years.
Right. Like, this is not new from the Trump perspective. Like, he has for a long time questioned the value of these alliances. So I think allies are right to react accordingly and need to push back strongly on this as much as they possibly can. That we had a visit from Theresa May over the last week where this was not a topic of like preeminent discussion, both in the public and in whatever the private discussions were, shows that like there is so much else going on that for some reason our fundamental alliances are not receiving top billing in the national security debate.
I think also, there have been reviews, many, many reviews of the election sort of after the fact and what the media didn't get wrong. And there is this sort of quip that the media took Trump literally but not seriously and his supporters took him seriously but not literally. Seems like we need to take him both seriously and literally.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's doing a lot of exactly what he said and exactly what his supporters voted for. And there's a component of this which is there is a democratic process here, and that process voted for these exact options and these exact sort of priorities that Trump is now espousing. Now, I think there was a view in the national security community that when he was faced with the decisions in a presidential context, that he might make different decisions. But that was premised on a whole bunch of different things.
Anybody
different
who still
process,
has that view is just not updating.
But
it's
also
like the worst Bayesian of all time.
Right.
Bad Bayesian.
Oh my God, dorks. So, but The question that I have on this issue is that, like, what do our allies do at this point? Like, how do they respond? Do they fundamentally change their thinking about U.S. support to them in their national security? Do they change their investment in their defense? I think they're to some degree still figuring this out, and it's coming at the worst possible time for the Germans with their election. I'm sorry, with the Germans, with the French, with their election coming up, with the U.K. and whether or not May has any credibility with her, you know, domestic politics.
And it matters in East Asia as well, right? It's not just, this is a classic extended deterrence problem. That's not just a function of commitments in one sphere.
Let's just be clear, much like with many things about Trump's proposals, there's a kernel here that he's tapping into of US frustration, which is the proportion of the US spending that is on defense is vastly higher than in any of our European allies. And in many of the actions we take, we tend to be funding it, even in cases like Libya, where we're sort of leading from behind or whatever.
This is basically the classic, right? Group project that you had when you were in fourth grade, and you knew you were going to be the one to do literally everything. As you know, when the teacher assigned it, you thought, like, I'm going to be the one who's writing, I'm going to be the one who's presenting, I'm going to be the one who's doing everything. These other guys will show up and contribute their 10%.
Or when you're writing a memo in the government.
Yeah, but I mean, we all were those persons.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
And part of the reason why you do that is you're just like, I'll do it. It's fine. I'll do it.
So that's exactly right? What I was going to say, which is, we all are talking here.
It's not like we wanted the Germans or the French to have a really robust, independent foreign policy at any point.
Absolutely.
God, can you imagine if that happened? Like, we would be like, what the hell are you guys doing?
Well, the French tried that, and we weren't super thrilled, right?
Remember Mali?
Remember Libya?
I was thinking of the 60s, but either way.
Yes. So, but my point here is that there's this sort of kernel of, do we want to push Europe and Asia and the Balts? And, you know, do we want to have a foreign policy where they do not live under the umbrella of protection that the U.S. provides, and thus they don't align themselves as more with our strategic interests because they want to sort of make sure we provide that. And that's the world that Trump ran on.
That's right.
Explicitly ran on and said, you know, that's what we are. And so that's kind of what we're experiencing now. And so the fact that there is a surprise and an adjustment period is not in and of itself surprising, but I think there's going to be a period of adjustment here. It's certainly a dramatic break, regardless of party, from the way the U.S. has executed foreign policy in the last,
for sure. I mean, there's certainly decades. Been an internationalist consensus, bipartisan consensus, at least at the elite level, for quite some time, and you potentially, you know, all the way back to 1945. I think that discussion there, Radha, is a great example. Like, there are two big streams, like follow-on effects there. If we don't want the world living under our umbrella, one of those relates to sort of economic nationalism. And some of the comments from the Bild and Times interviews that didn't get covered as much were actually about the EU. And part of why he doesn't value NATO, and part of why Trump sort of doesn't see the value in that relationship, is he sees Germany as an economic competitor and Europe as an economic competitor. And so why would we be doing things to, you know, ease their defense spending or provide security?
And just as a reminder, I'm an economist. So now
I always forget.
I know. I do such a good undercover job. But so I think that's right, right? And we have, for the last few decades, kind of thought about foreign national security policy as being sort of preeminent, and economic competition as being sort of, peace promotes economic prosperity, and so rising tide lifts all boats, and here we are. Well, I mean, it might have lifted all boats overall, but some boats were lifted a lot more than others. And so now we're in a world where actually what we're saying is the economic competition is sort of the preeminent force. And let's talk about prioritizing U.S. economic outcomes, even if that means we grow overall less as a world and even as a U.S., and even if that comes at the expense of existing alliance and commitments. And that's not, again, just to be clear, that is exactly what Trump ran on. That is the populist message he sold, and that sort of is what the American voters voted for.
But so the other piece of this, though, the other, like, by necessity, you know, follow-on effect is, if the rest of the world's not living under our umbrella, what is the nature of that umbrella? I mean, it's not for rain, right? It's a nuclear umbrella, right? So are we saying we're okay with a German nuclear program? I'm not sure I'm signing up for that. Are we okay with the South Korean or a Japanese nuclear program? I mean, that is by extension what comes if people are no longer living under our extended deterrence, nuclear umbrella, you know, all of the good stuff that came with us shouldering that burden, essentially providing, in what a book that I just read and was doing a review for, you know, global public goods, right? This was a thing that we were doing, you know, for the benefit of a lot of other people so that they could rebuild entire economies and not be subject to the whims of populism and sort of the vagaries of economic nationalism. We're right back in that.
Well, this is what's fascinating about how the foreign policy blob of Washington is reacting to all of Trump's policies is that they went to school in, you know, the last decade, last two decades, with all of these assumptions in place that, you know, the United States was part of NATO, that NATO was sacrosanct, that the U.S. Security assurance was, you know, basically an immovable object. And to have them confronted with the fact that, like, maybe this may not be the case and maybe there's some other interest at play, it's like watching somebody just be completely drugged. Like, they don't even know how to react. I mean, I include myself in this. Of, like, I can't start with the level of assumptions that requires me to adjust my entire worldview here. And to the extent that I think a lot of people are saying, like, well, he doesn't really mean it, or he won't mean it if there's a crisis going on, or anything like that. And I think we need to take him seriously and literally that actually, no, he really does mean it. All of these assumptions we have held true for the last decade, for the last two decades, even longer than that, are completely false. And basically, that means that I need to cry into my pillow and wonder, why did I read all of those books when I was in grad school?
That's an existential question that I'm not sure we have time to resolve here, today.
I will say, just sort of to put another frame on this, is, look, if we can understand what Trump's objective is, if it's improving U.S. economic performance, then maybe that's the frame we need to put this in. And if there's an act of persuasion to be had here, it is maintaining these alliances, maintaining this protection, maintaining this helps U.S. America first economic policy, right? And that's a different frame than we in the national security community, and even we, the economists, have been putting on national security issues. But it's one worth sort of thinking about going forward.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that's, getting people to think more. I mean, certainly in the think tank space, certainly in other parts of the advocacy space, you know, how do you persuade anyone who might be listening as to the net benefits long-term and short-term of these arrangements? But these are, these are also long-held views. Like, I'm not really, they're pretty strong priors, right? So I'm not really sure how amenable they are to new information. See, you know what that was. You made a face. We knew we were talking about Bayesian stuff with priors. You know, you're not less of a dork than us. Don't give me that, Lauren.
Okay. I didn't get, a PhD like these guys. But I swear I know things. I do.
Yes,
really do.
We know you do. That's why you're
here.
That's
why we make the jokes, because they're funny.
All right. So of the many things that have been happening, that is we are going to, we've talked about two things that happened outside of Washington and still managed to mostly talk about Washington the entire time. We're going to take a brief interlude. We have a middle segment, What Are We Drinking? To which I would also like to ask you, lovely ladies, what is your favorite podcast? So I think we can start. I don't know what you've been drinking in your spare time, such as that is. But today in the podcast, as I tweeted last night, we are drinking bourbon. I had a full bottle of Buffalo Trace 40 minutes ago. It is no longer
much
full.
Much less than full now.
We're making progress.
We're making progress. We've got a little bit of ice. We got a little bit of ginger ale, and we are thoroughly enjoying the bourbony goodness. No bitters, no lemon, no fanciness. I'm not a walking bar cart here.
It's coming. Don't worry. Bitters are coming.
But we've got a nice. We've done some damage on this Buffalo Trace, and I'm proud of us today. So, Lauren, what's your favorite podcast?
My favorite podcast is probably Rational Security, mostly because I know most of the people on it in either in real life or in Twitter life, which is kind of like real life, but not exactly. And I love hearing what they sound like and what they actually have views on Rational Security. Also, they tend to drink a lot of scotch on their podcast. And they have their object lesson at the very end and are kind of all generally fabulous, wonderful individuals. I highly recommend listening to them after you listen to us. They tend to have a lot of law degrees, which is frankly not as cool as the PhD dorkiness that we have in this room.
They don't have favorite statistical distributions, would be my guess. Maybe they do.
Maybe
I would love
do.
To find out.
Maybe they
I
do.
Can out-regression them.
I will also add that what I have been drinking over the last week on top of this lovely Buffalo Trace is champagne in the shower. Not on weekdays because, I'm not a peasant. But on weekends, champagne in the shower in the morning is basically the best possible thing you can do for
That's
yourself.
That's a substantial upgrade
as
from
an
a
adult.
Shower beer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a shower beer is what you do before you go out in the evening.
On vacation, right. In my experience.
A champagne shower is like what you do in the morning when you're like, this is going to be a tough day. My son woke up at 5 a.m. asking for pizza. And you know what's not available at 5 a.m.? Pizza.
Noted. Rada, what is your favorite podcast? Right now, I should say, because a podcast can evolve over time, obviously.
So I'm going to go with Political Gabfest.
The Slate Political Gabfest.
And Emily Bazelon and David Plotz, if you're listening, let's hang out. Seriously, I'll come to New Haven.
Really?
Emily's in New Haven, and I will hang out with her there.
That's bold, because that's New Haven.
They have excellent pizza there.
Sure.
Ish. I'm from New York, so.
Yeah. It has clams. That's gross.
True. Or mashed potatoes. Anyway, I have a lot of New Haven knowledge. Don't judge. I do miss, like both of you, John Dickerson, and will also totally make an exception, even though you're not on the Gabfest, to hang out with you. But I enjoy their political commentary, and also, you know, I am not myself a lawyer and enjoy the sort of legal analysis of what's going on, so I can kind of understand that side of things too. And for drinking this week, I was visiting my parents in New York, and I have been enjoying the Pierre Ferrand Cognac 1840, which
fancy.
Is very my fancy.
God, I'm going to go visit your mom and dad.
That's what I'm saying.
If you live in Kansas, you do not drink Pierre whatever
but
cognac.
It's like a old school cognac, which tastes more like whiskey, which, as you guys may have gathered from the past, I am a big fan of, but also allows you to do things like, let's randomly add grapefruit bitters. That's the thing, and it's delicious. So just do it. Get some cognac, drink it at night. You'll feel very fancy, and frankly, you know, it's only been, you know, 10 days. 9 days, so you're probably going to need some fancy cognac.
I would agree with that. I think that's a good stock, you know, for your prepping, for your, you know, any liberal prepping that's going on out there.
It's
for
important
the resistance.
To invest in you, and I invest right.
Self care
is very important. Important as a, you know, mid-30s/40s woman, self care.
We're big fans. My most recent favorite podcast is Crime Town. Which
I don't even know this. I'm very excited.
It's a Gimlet podcast from the Gimlet Media Empire. But it focuses.
Wait, this doesn't involve
she's making
policy?
Fancy faces.
I don't know what this means.
Yeah, see, I can only listen to us talk about things for so long. Okay. Like, I get over it. But Crime Town this season, and it's the first season, is about Providence. It's about the Providence mob. And so it is like thick New England accents, a lot of profanity, and the political economy of mob rule. Which, of course, I am super here for. So,
can I make a confession that I have held to myself for like 5, 6 years, maybe 10 years, maybe
please
in my
do.
Whole life? I don't know what political economy means, even though I say it a lot. I say it.
I
all
love everything
the time.
About this moment right now.
I say it all the time, and I have no idea what it means. And this is my confession. I apologize to everyone who has paid me to use that term ever in the past.
I think the short answer, although I'm not the economist, I'm the Paul in the political economy, maybe, but I did not do well in game theory, so take this with a grain of salt.
Let's
but,
do some game theory, everyone.
No, never. Never again. Hashtag never again on the game theory. The political economy is the, you know, aggregation of individual interests for societal outcomes. Right, so you want to model what's going on in a particular neighborhood or city or country, and you're going to do that by modeling individual preferences and behaviors.
And because we're fancy economists, we bring in things like political institutions. Okay. I'm using air quotes, everyone. And laws and government structures. And sometimes governments can even like have their own objectives that aren't the same, crazy, crazy guys, as the people that elected them.
Most economists are not aware of that, in my experience. That's a very political. That's the very best. That's the Paul in the political economy.
I'm just saying, we're wild and crazy over on the economic side. You're not the boss of us.
Okay. Right. Nobody's believing this. So I think we need to move on to a segment we don't have a name for yet, but we're for right now calling White House Mayhem. I think that's going to get us quite a ways here.
We don't speak for our institutions.
Oh my God, not at all. Very much not at all.
I'll be honest, what I wanted to do in this segment was to find a debater, of which I know an excessive number of, to like read the headlines from the last 2 weeks, because the only way we could get through all the news that has happened was to be have somebody like spew them out, and it would basically end with a tournament.
Can I make
lies.
A confession that, you know, I am the New York State high school debate champion from my senior year?
Is that a confession or a humble bag?
Oh my
Brett?
God.
A little bit of both. I try to keep it on the DL.
Everybody at home, please apply for Rada.
I can talk really
send
fast.
Her some flowers.
In the past. Not now. Not that fast.
I'm not going to make the other confessions that go along with that from the great state of Kansas, but There's a debate mafia out there. We know you're listening. We appreciate it. So we don't have that, and we don't have me coming up with new lyrics to It's the End of the World as We Know It,
soon.
Which I would like to do very, very much so. We're going to start with a quick rundown, though. Lauren, remind me who we have confirmed since we last met with our fine listeners.
Okay. So obviously we have the generals confirmed because they are the most important. Secretary Mattis, Secretary Kelly. They are both confirmed as the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security. Also, I am pretty sure that Mike Pompeo is confirmed.
Correct.
As is the ambassador to the UN from the United States. Oddly, Rex Tillerson, who is the Secretary of State,
that's Nikki
Haley.
Technically
her boss, is not confirmed. So far as we understand, based on today's political decisions, those are the confirmed people.
And we're still waiting for Tillerson, obviously, and Rick Perry.
Correct. It's the Department of Energy, which, just to remind our listeners, is in charge of the nuclear weapons. So we do care about them.
Well, Radha cares about them. She's trying to convince the rest of us to care about that. So, okay, so we've had some confirmations. We had a big inauguration speech, which maybe wasn't the most typical of inauguration speeches.
But entirely consistent with the campaign.
That's right.
Just, again, literally and seriously.
Let's shift gears slightly. So on the White House mayhem, I mean, we literally don't have time. We have like 15-ish minutes, and we can maybe, extend a little bit longer for the, insanity that has occurred in the last, 2 weeks. But the sort of biggest hits, and you guys chime in here.
I don't even think it's been 2 weeks, guys.
Well, it's been 2 weeks since we had a podcast, and that's how my calendar currently runs. I'm on.
That's right.
It's like Thermidor, so it's just a couple. I'm basically, it's like, we're T+14 as far as I'm concerned for reporting. We had even before the inauguration. Let me remind you, Bradley Manning.
That's still a thing.
What is that? I mean, what happened?
Chelsea Manning,
a lifetime ago.
Whew.
Okay. We had strong thoughts on that.
Chelsea Manning. Like, I lost my mind when the Chelsea Manning not pardon
then got it back and lost it again.
Came down. Like 7 years ago, whenever that was, that actually happened, that Chelsea Manning had his sentence commuted by the President of the United States to say that she had served her time, that she had expressed regret about her actions in leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents to the press. And that, that her sentence was not comparable to other people who had leaked classified information in the past. So those are all possibly true. They're all probably true. But I think we all had some pretty visceral reactions to that moment that I would be interested in hearing about from Radha.
So I'm of two minds of this. I think it's really important to recognize that Chelsea Manning was going through a difficult transition here. And that the military prisons are not a place for a person looking to conduct gender-confirming medical treatments.
Really, let's be honest. Military prisons are not a place for basically anyone. But
right.
Let's leave that aside for the moment.
But so I think there were options here that could have been humanitarian to help her be in a place that is more, at least, safe for someone who identifies as transgender. Still recognize the fact that she leaked tremendous amounts of classified information. Tremendous amounts. And most of those didn't serve any sort of whistleblower or national security interest. There's no argument here as to this is not the Pentagon Papers. This is a massive leak of classified information that undermined our diplomatic and military operations. And I think a different set of options could have been on the table to moving her to different types of prisons, to making available different kinds of treatments, to counseling and support. I think there are a range of humanitarian options that I would have been highly supportive of that retain the, here's the thing, we don't leak classified information. It does not matter. We don't do it. And if you do it, you get punished.
And I guess I'm surprised a little bit to find myself on the less severe side.
Are you a humanitarian?
Never. Okay. Almost never. This didn't bother me. I had no problem distinguishing Chelsea Manning's case from Edward Snowden's, for whom I have no sympathy and no compassion, and find to, you know, despite my monthly donations to the ACLU, I find their advocacy for him to be really frustrating and misplaced.
This is one of the things that, like, I focused on since this came out, since Robin Raffel, the story came out in the Wall Street Journal, that our national security system that looks at classified information is completely screwed up. And we are prosecuting the right people, the wrong people, and people that should never, are basically just doing their job on a day-to-day basis and not really looking at whether or not our system is actually protecting the information that we want.
Yeah, I think that that's, I mean, I don't have any optimism of that there'll be a thorough and well-thought systematic review, but there is some part of me that would like to just completely blow up the NISPOM, which is the set of regulations that that guard and guide industry and everybody else who has a clearance.
Look, post the disclosures and the Snowden leaks, and post, I mean, this is a related but separate issue of people who are cleared committing massive amounts of violence, like the Navy Yard shooter and the Fort Hood shooter, right? Like, we're in a world where people with very trusted amounts of information leak that information, commit serious crimes, have serious illness. So this is a system that is worth a deep and careful look away from the political lens and towards the how do we protect information that is vital to our national interests. And that's something that needs to happen.
So all of that feels like maybe 39,000 years ago.
Roughly.
It does.
Yeah.
So much, much closer to home. Although maybe only 10,000 years ago was President Trump's speech at the CIA the day after the inauguration in front of the famous Wall of Stars. And we're going to come back and talk about why the Wall of Stars is important. We also have had executive orders on both refugees and immigration restrictions, but also reorganization of the National Security Council. One of those was signed. The refugee order was signed along with an executive order, which, as far as I can tell, means literally nothing about increasing the size of the military, which you can't do by executive order. You can only do through acts of Congress, which the House Armed Services Committee Twitter feed pointed out immediately in a very snarky manner, which was maybe not in keeping with my understanding of how the HASC majority worked. But we've had as we've talked about here, we've had a number of substantive changes to policy. We've also had some process, or at least symbolic uses of, whether it's the Wall of Stars or the Hall of Heroes at the Pentagon, where two of these executive orders were signed. And that's, neither of those sat well with at least a certain segment of the national security community. And so we all had some reactions to that.
So I just want to dive right in on the Wall of Stars here. And I think
that's at the CIA.
That's at the CIA.
The headquarters in Langley.
At the headquarters in Langley. And I think in America, there's a tendency to think about intelligence officers, especially pre-Homeland, as people who sat in offices and pushed papers and looked at information. And there are certainly those people, and those people are vital to our national security. They literally
protect this country. Or to think of them as James Bond in sort of a tuxedo, right, in a very fancy car.
But there are people who go about every day never being recognized for their work. And some of them die in the line of service. And unlike our military officers, and I say this with the utmost respect for military officers who give their ultimate sacrifice, that the folks at the CIA who die in the line of service often can't be recognized. Often their families can't know what they've done. Their names aren't on gravestones. Their wreaths aren't placed in front of their gravestone every Christmas. And the one memory they have is a star on a wall in an office building in Virginia. And I think to have any kind of political speech, regardless of the president, regardless of the administration, regardless of the message, there without fully recognizing the measure of sacrifice that was given by those people is really astounding. And I know I have a number of close colleagues and friends and a number of people, and I myself felt really strongly that there could have been more done here to recognize the sacrifice and service of those people and the people at the CIA more broadly, and in the intelligence community more broadly, who do this sort of everyday service.
So in looking at this, I just want to think about the fact that if I had volunteered to be a CIA officer and I was one of those people that was on that wall, there are people that are memorialized there whose names are not even written down in the book that describes their actions. To this day, their families don't know what happened. To this day, we don't discuss publicly their actions, what they sacrificed, and what their cause was for the United States. And that is a level of service to our country that I just can't even fathom. And to this day, I have thought long and hard about the fact that, like, this is not something that I don't think I would be capable of doing. For the president or anybody else to stand there and not understand that, not recognize that, and to basically, you know, think about poll numbers or the number of people that were attending an inauguration is just such a disconnect to be, like, it's not even possible really to describe.
It reminds me, at the end of Argo, this movie that came a couple years ago with Ben Affleck, right, that talks about an operation after the U.S. embassy in Tehran had come under siege. There's a line at the end of that movie that is, if we wanted applause, we would have joined the circus. And it's the sort of thing that describes a lot of the selfless work and sacrifice of government employees across a number of agencies, but is, of course, specific to CIA. Lauren, you pointed out earlier that this parallels the ceremony in the Hall of Heroes at the Pentagon on Friday, just a few days ago, in terms of also having political purposes and leveraging some symbolism and symbology in a way that didn't sit super well with you.
Yeah, so the Hall of Heroes, this is where we memorialize the people that are honored with the Medal of Honor, many of whom are honored posthumously after their death. So these are people who make the ultimate sacrifice for their country. They are people who commit acts of bravery that, you know, that a Hollywood producer would say that's far-fetched. This is not possible that you've actually committed this. We're not going to put this in a movie. But these are people who are real. And the president went there to sign an order that, you know, was to increase the armed forces. And, you know, that's probably fine. It was a fairly benign executive order. But the second one, in which he decided to make what was one of his campaign promises, which was to ban people from countries like Syria and Iraq, that were to ban Muslims from our refugee process. This was a political act that was incredibly uncomfortable for a lot of people for a number of reasons. One, this is a sacred space. This is where you talk about the sacrifice of young men and women who, you know, decide to do their utmost for their country. And then two, that this is a place where those men and women were helped enormously by a lot of the people who are coming into this country as refugees. The interpreters, the people who worked as staff for the military in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, that the president signed an executive order in this space that is keeping out people who gave everything to make sure that our men and women in uniform were kept safe overseas, and that, you know, they spent 17 hours in detention, that they were in handcuffs, that they were told that you cannot enter this country, is offensive in a way that I don't think that is really possible to describe to people who are not, you know, conscious of this on a day-to-day basis.
So I just want to, like, put a slightly finer point. I already did this on the CIA one, but I want to do it on the Hall of Heroes one. The Medal of Honor, the people that have sacrificed here go back in time in a way that recognizes people who are willing to fight and die for American values and for America as a concept. And this includes people going back to the Civil War. My husband gave a speech on someone named Alonzo Cushing, who was at Pickett's Charge, who was from a town very near his hometown, and he had worked on this at the White House. And he gave the speech describing these acts of valor of one person who at one time did one thing to fight and die for America. And these are the people who are represented here. So for any, regardless of whether you agree or disagree, regardless of the political spectrum, regardless of the purposes, this is a sort of sacred space that at the Department of Defense, civilian and military personnel alike really recognize as a space to honor what it means to give that last full measure. And I think to sort of move beyond that is a real change in how we as America treat that type of sacrifice. And that was sort of deeply moving and concerning to me. regardless of what type, regardless of whether I agreed with it or disagreed with it in political orders is kind of in some ways second order, is that this is a space where that is the actions we do there honor that sacrifice.
Yeah, honestly, the president could have signed an order that said like that smiles are a nice thing to do and made that an executive order. And I would have said that that's an appropriate thing to do in the Hall of Heroes. This is not where you talk about politics. This is where you talk about the sacrifices of men and women in uniform. And I mean, he didn't even bother to link the case for why we're doing this as an executive order to what was going on in that room. And it felt as though in many ways that this was a political prop for him. And that was really uncomfortable for a lot of people.
And the other political prop in that, potentially in that situation, was also to watch Secretary Mattis, watch him sign both of those executive orders. And at this point, I think we don't really know exactly whether Secretary Mattis knew that both orders were going to be signed, both in terms of enlarging the military, but also the refugee and immigration order. But that certainly is, for me at least, was a troubling sort of visual to watch him overlooking that process. Let's talk just briefly. We are, you know, at this point essentially at our time, but I want us to talk both about the refugee order and a little bit on the NSC reorg.
So let's link this for a minute to the National Security Presidential Memorandum that was signed on Saturday on the National Security Council process. Because, you know, while one sounds horrifically boring and bureaucratic, I think it's actually pretty relevant to how this EO came to be. So two huge changes took place in this memorandum from the Obama administration. One, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the director of National Intelligence were basically told that you can come to principals committee meetings, which are meetings chaired by the National Security Advisor involving other national security principals like the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Attorney General, and others, that the DNI and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs will show up when there are issues relevant to their areas of responsibility. Okay, well, that sounds totally rational because, frankly, can you imagine a national security issue where the Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs shouldn't show up? Probably not. The second change was that Steve Bannon, who is the President's Chief Strategist, was added to the National Security Council. This is unprecedented and completely bizarre in a way that I just want to make clear, like, how really uncomfortable that feels to national security professionals. Steve Bannon...
On both sides of the aisle.
Right, on both sides of the aisle, right, between Republicans and Democrats. And the Bush administration, Karl Rove was told by President Bush that he would not be attending National Security Council meetings. To be clear, in the Obama administration, David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and a few others occasionally attended, but it was abundantly clear to everybody in the room that they were backbenchers, they were there for their situational awareness, and they were not there for substantive decisions.
And they weren't there by executive order. They were there on an ad hoc basis
By the president's invitation. Okay, so you look at these two things and you're like, all right, maybe these aren't that big a deal. But then you look at the events of the last weekend, and we are told by the press secretary and others that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the director of national intelligence will be included in these discussions when their presence is needed, when it is an issue that matters to their organization. You look at Secretary Kelly and you find that he was not included in the debate on the EO. He was briefed on the EO as it was being signed. So if this Secretary Kelly...
The Homeland Security Secretary, right, is not right, being
who
included.
Oversees Customs and Border Patrol. Right. They're underneath his... They're one of the action arms of his organization.
And is not part of the internal discussions such as they were. I mean, we are told, I think, from what I've read, that they had some period for review. And in fact, it's even worse than them being excluded. There was some information provided to the White House from DHS, from the Department of Homeland Security.
Right, that was overruled.
That was overruled, which was related to this explicit issue of green card holders. And whoever in the White House, we think it was Steve Miller and Steve Bannon, decided that they didn't want to incorporate that into the executive order. They were going to press ahead with what they had drafted already.
So if the executive order that the Trump administration issued on the national security process ask us to trust them that they'll include the right people at the right time in the process on the right issues, but I think their behavior over the last week completely, you know, has zero credibility on that issue. They didn't include Secretary Kelly on an issue that he has to implement. Regardless of your, you know, policy or political disagreement with this topic, whether even if you 100% think that there should be no refugees from any of these countries coming in, the implementation was an embarrassment. The implementation was such that we had 88-year-old blind, disabled men being told that they were a threat to our country and they were not allowed in, and CBP agents crying as they were being begging for guidance from the White House.
And just to be clear, even in the best case scenarios, right, where the officials at the White House in charge of these issues do their very best to create actionable and operationalizable, is that a word? Guidance. They don't know what they don't know. And that's the reason that we have an interagency process. The reason we have it is so that people can say, hey, I used to be a CBP agent and now I came up here. Oh, the guy who works down the hall from me knows this. Or these are the issues we're concerned about as an agency. And those types of interagency processes, frankly, happen at much lower levels than the Secretary of DHS and the White House Chief of Staff and the White House National Security Advisor. And that interagency process helps create policies and decisions that can be immediately actioned. And so here, even if you agreed with 100% all of the actions that were included here, a process that allowed individuals to inform it so that it could be operationalized in a humane way. I mean, look, these are people we're talking about. And even if you think they should be turned away, they should be turned away in a way that is respectful and with dignity and that recognizes that some of them have spent decades putting their lives on the line serving as translators for our military armed services. And even if you think those people should be turned away, we ought to have our Customs and Border Patrol law enforcement officers with the guidance they need to make those decisions instead of having to just say, well, you should call the president because if you get an answer, let me know.
Well, and I think that the question that, I mean, this speaks to some very fundamental questions of the rule of law. If you have a visa to legally enter this country and it turns out that on the next day it's not valid, that is a really troubling place, not only for green card holders to be in, but for anybody with a valid visa. And I find that really, really, really upsetting. So this is an issue hopefully is going to continue and we'll be able to revisit it in future podcasts. Lauren, you spoke to this question of the reorganization of the National Security Council. I don't know if we have a lot more there to explore. I think we're all waiting to see how this plays out, both in terms of statute, but also in terms of palace intrigue, for lack of a better term, whether General Flynn will be able to kind of muster all of these forces for something resembling an effective interagency process, which most of these folks don't have a lot of experience with. But I think we see from this weekend is necessary even for effective policies that, I mean, I for one disagree with. But if you want them done, you do have to use the bureaucracy to get them done properly.
Right. And this is where the presence of Steve Bannon is a little bizarre. I mean, so Steve Bannon's job is to talk about President Trump's political agenda. Like, this is what he's paid for. This is what he shows up to the office for on a day-to-day basis. That's fine. I have no problem with that. Him trying to implement this agenda in the context of the National Security Council without the input of the rest of the National Security Council on how to actually do this properly in a way that is even effective is utterly bizarre.
Like, I think, I think the way to think about it is if you suddenly had a spokesperson saying, hey, GM, build this totally different car. There are no engineers involved. There was no one involved in the manufacturing process.
It's a Simpsons episode about this.
No adjustments made to the machinery or production.
It just looks really pretty, so you should build it.
I drew it on my whiteboard.
Just build it.
Right. And so I think regardless of sort of political points and sort of public rhetoric, there is a bureaucracy and a process that needs to happen for the car to get built. And what we're waiting to see is how that process, the machinery on building the car, gets instituted, because straight out of the gate right now there are no cars being built.
Right.
There's a new picture.
It looks like there's a vision with a cartoon of like, here's what the car should maybe look like, and nobody actually designing the car in the background.
We'll wait and see what this looks like 2 and 4 and 6 weeks and months from now. Shifting gears entirely to our final segment, which basically speaks to my pop culture interests more broadly. I love the intersection of national security and foreign policy and pop culture. I don't promise that we'll speak to that intersection every week, but there are at least two things we wanted to talk about this week in our final section. One of which was how much we did not like this last run of Sherlock, and also whether anybody had seen La La Land. We are in awards season with regard to the Oscars and everything else. I watch a lot of movies. I like movies and television. But Sherlock, which has often been amazing, had one sort of decent episode in this last stretch here, but the final episode was awful.
Terrible.
Yeah, basically, Sherlock only makes sense if you are watching Sherlock while he's solving an episode where he is having to interact with society in some way, and you have to see how Sherlock is completely not at all a normal human being when it compares to, like, other average human beings he has to interact with on a day-to-day basis. So the last episode put Sherlock on basically an island that was sort of like the movie Saw times 10, but with his sister, and his brother is apparently a total coward, which is also not really like what something I would totally believe. And they all were just like, yes, we will play along with your crazy games, sister crazy person who we have never heard of before, which I recognize makes no sense to all of the non-Sherlock watchers. But like, I just felt like it was them trying to tie up a lot of strings and having no idea where to go. And I love John Watson more than anyone on the face of the earth. And that's my last point.
I mean, what they've done with John Watson in this particular version of Sherlock, which is to make him a veteran of the modern Afghanistan war and an adrenaline junkie such that he is not just devoted to Sherlock as a person, which makes complete sense in the way that they've constructed this character of John Watson.
But it's basically his morphine. Sherlock is his morphine, and he needs to hit it up on a regular basis. And when he doesn't, he becomes a sad, pathetic, sad, angry man. His wife talks about this in her death video, which, let's talk about how creepy that is. That you're like, hey, go hang out with your creepy
also
morphine buddy.
So sad that this is her best part of her character is
for sure
post-death.
Was the death video.
Way better.
Way more interesting than when she was alive.
But what I would say is bummer. None of this episode would have worked if instead of a sister, that was a brother. Right? It's this creepy, weird lady that no one takes seriously and sneaks out. It's just ridiculous. The whole thing, the entire premise is ridiculous. And I felt vaguely resentful that it was his sister. Because let me tell you, if I was going to be the sociopathic sister, I'd be way better than that chick.
There had been a good article.
That's who I identify in the episode.
There was a good article a few weeks from the first episode about why the Sherlock writers struggle with female characters.
None of them are female.
Well, so there's that. But they're like, you know, basically there was a lot of objections to my favorite episode, which was the Belgravia.
The woman. Right? Oh my God, I love the woman.
That's the best episode by far, in my opinion. But lots of folks objected to that and sort of objected to how she was objectified and sexualized and was the only person that had any engagement.
She whipped people. Who cares?
But the women of the Sherlock series are not well represented nor well cared for.
It just roughly reminds me of reading Charles Dickens. Where, like, they're good stories. I don't want to get in a whole fight on Charles Dickens. But they're good stories, but all of the women suck.
They're terrible.
They're just terrible. And I just want someone who's the Buffy the Vampire Slayer of the Sherlock series. That's all I'm looking for here. Some quips, some ass kicking. It's just, you know, let's call it a day.
Well, this is why Irene Adler was amazing. She kicked Sherlock's ass. And it was
beautiful. It's fair.
Most beautiful ass kicking of all time.
And
Sherlock
still
loved it.
And still in the end, he rescues her. So there's some, it's problematic at a...
While she's in a hijab. Let's not even talk about
right.
this.
Right. It's a little complicated. All right.
Well, La La Land. Watch it. It will make you feel good about the world to escape for a few hours. Plus, download the soundtrack. The songs are good.
You should also do some stress-reducing tap dancing, a la Gilmore Girls.
Oh, my God.
Like, the revival was total crap. But that
terrible.
Was a
But the tap dancing
amazing,
idea,
amazing
it did
moment.
Speak to my soul.
Stress-reducing tap dancing, I think, is something that all of the Bombshell listeners can take on board, male or female. That's the direction that we're going.
Ryan, I want to see some stress-inducing tap dancing.
This has been Bombshell, our production by War on the Rocks. Thanks for listening. Good night.